You know what? I never planned to be a CEO. To be honest, that was never an ambition for me. For me, it was all about looking at challenges, coming across them, and doing what's right, you know, and to my best ability. That's kind of how I have been on my career. So I never really ever thought I would ever be a CEO.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit. Nilima and I have been doing this for a while. And we wanted to say something that's obvious but must be said, and that is that the opinions expressed on the show are our own and that of our guests and do not represent the views of our employers. With that out of the way, let's start with our episode. We have an amazing guest today who took the company through an exit just a few months ago, and we have a lot to discuss with him. But before we get into the main segment of the show, let's do a quick review of this week in exits. And boy, did we have a big week or what? Slack was acquired by Salesforce for $27.7 billion in one of the largest ever tech acquisitions. We'll give you a perspective on this in a bit, but I still can't wrap my head around the fact that the company that was just founded a little over a decade ago, went IPO a year ago, was sold for close to $28 billion. Gets to show the power of SaaS, infinite scale, network effects, and more. Nilima, what's your take on the acquisition?
Yeah, Ankur, this is the largest B2B SaaS acquisition. So on that alone, it's a pretty impressive outcome. Let's take a look at some of the numbers. To start with, all was not rosy in this picture. If you take a look at Slack's last quarter's earnings, it posted a revenue growth of 49% year over year for $215.9 million, beating Wall Street expectations. And guess what? Slack's shares fell almost 20% after hours. Why? Because Wall Street was comparing its growth with another COVID favorite, Zoom, who reported a 355% surge in revenue in the same time. Now, let's take at another metric, which is the DAU numbers. Slack has chosen not to disclose its daily active users numbers since October 2019, when it had reported about 12 million DAUs. Instead, they have recently started focusing on paying users, as this is the number that really impacts the revenue. Microsoft Teams, a competitor of Slack, on the other hand, is updating this number every quarter now. They reported 115 million daily active users as of October, up from 75 million it announced in the late April earlier this year. So all in all, it was clearly getting harder for Slack to show an explosive growth story, which its counterparts are showing in the COVID time.
Yeah, pretty good take. I think they were certainly seeing a lot of pressure from Microsoft with Teams, which kind of combined the video conferencing capabilities with all the collaboration, obviously bundled it as part of their one of the Office bundles. So from that perspective, they were definitely seeing a lot of heat from them. But and I'd always maintained when we started using Slack 7-8 years ago that email killer was going to be an application that is not even close to being an email, but that looks completely different. And Slack was it. Kind of Yammer tried it before Slack. Salesforce actually had a product called Chatter, but you know, none of them kind of really could quite get to Slack's popularity. And that's, you know, largely in part due to amazing execution by Stuart Butterfield and Slack's team. You know, our listeners know the product, so I won't go too much into the kind of the product aspect of it. The thing that was interesting to me was, they were one of the two companies at scale who kind of got the bottoms up go-to-market right. You know, Box and Dropbox and Aha and several other arguably amazing products solved the problem really well, started with the bottoms up go-to-market, organic, groundswell, line of businesses signing up, but couldn't quite get to Slack or Atlassian level popularity. So really kudos to them. But like you mentioned, the thing that would have been challenging for Slack is that when you build your go-to-market bottoms up, and then you try to either pivot or augment through a tops down, hiring a enterprise sales force, hundreds of them, thousands of them competing with companies like Microsoft would have been a challenge. And from that perspective, acquisition with Salesforce was amazing because Salesforce has got one of the best sales forces in the world. And what Salesforce gets out of this is that they already had access to the marketing business unit, customer success, they had the sales, obviously, BUs, but Slack gives them every enterprise users. So now they can get every enterprise user seat in terms of licensing. And then obviously Slack has a lot of these intercompany connectivity parts of it. So that's going to improve their CRM core product as well. So I think all in all, good acquisition, amazing for Salesforce who, you know, starting with CRM, want to be the SaaS company. And I could see them getting to half a trillion with Slack and maybe a few other acquisitions. They've already acquired Tableau and, you know, MuleSoft and a few other companies. So if you're a SaaS founder, my key takeaways: from zero until a certain size, hundreds of millions of dollars in ARR, bottoms-up marketing does work if you build the product with that in mind. You know, groundswell, get the users to love the product, have some sort of a free freemium type model. Inherent network effects and virality will take the product at least to the next level where you either augment with tops down or guess get acquired by a company like Salesforce.
I completely agree with the last takeaway. I think it's hard to show growth on Wall Street with just bottoms up go to market. There definitely needs to be a top down story to show the growth potential, which is what, as you said, Salesforce combined with Slack would look like. At a macro level, this deal could also trigger a wave of other M&As for other competitors like Google Cloud and ServiceNow, focused on the collaboration market. So from that perspective, I'm really excited because collaboration tools space, I think, has truly arrived with this acquisition.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an amazing time to be living in, building SaaS products. It just keeps getting better and better. The acquisitions keep getting higher and higher. So, you know, amazing times. Great. Well, with that, let's now get right into the main segment of the episode. In today's show, we have Rahul Kashyap, President and CEO of Awake Security, an AI-driven network security platform for clients and cloud services. Awake had a successful exit just 3 months ago when it was acquired by Arista Networks, a leader in building high-performance networks for data centers and cloud. Rahul joined Awake as a CEO a little over 2 years ago and played a major role in seeing the company through a successful outcome. He also had leadership roles at Cylance, which was acquired by BlackBerry, E8, Security acquired by VMware, and Bromium acquired by HP. In addition to his full-time job of running companies, Rahul is also a frequent keynote speaker at industry events, author of numerous security publications, and was named one of Silicon Valley's 40 under 40. He's also passionate about girls' education, which we'll talk about in a bit. Hey, Rahul. First of all, congratulations on the exit. I know it hasn't been too long, but has it sunk in yet? What are your emotions and those who have been with the company since the beginning?
It's been a fascinating year, first of all, for everybody, as you can all imagine. And this is something which, honestly, we just had not planned. It just came our way and things just moved in the positive direction. And we're actually very glad we made that choice. And we are very happy with the integrations we have been working with the Arista team so far. And the synergies are very clear. We are building the security capabilities for a very well-known networking giant, which was also built from scratch as well. So we are really, really excited to work and look at the future ahead of us.
What was the post-acquisition virtual party like?
yeah, it was all virtual alcohol, you can say. Yeah, even celebration is kind of very different now in this world, right? So we have been getting used to the, you know, celebrations over Zoom. So yeah, so we did get together. We opened a bottle of champagne with the team all over Zoom, and we celebrated together. It's a pity we could not be together because I'm kind of very close to my team. I know I'm used to being with them all the time. And this is the moment where I would have loved to be with them in person. But I'm sure a time will come later next year, hopefully, where we'll all be together in one place, which would be amazing, right? So,
absolutely.
Rahul, both Ankur and I have also been part of the acquisition journey. So it brings some memories, very vivid memories. And I cannot imagine actually getting acquired and, you know, doing it all remotely because so many things happened in the rooms, the discussion. So yes, definitely an interesting aspect. And we'll discuss this more about the Awake's journey in a bit, but I want to start off with your journey. How did you get into cybersecurity? And also, What was the journey like going from an engineering background to becoming a CEO?
Yeah, I think there are several pieces there. First of all, let me start off with my background. I kind of was very passionate for cybersecurity right before my grad school times. And finally, I got into an engineering college, which I really liked. And I pursued cybersecurity as a hobby. And this is like the late 1990s, where cybersecurity was mostly hacking and fun. So that's kind of how I got there. You know, I still remember I used to figure out ways to reboot the server of my lab every time my teacher used to come to me to asking for my assignments. I kind of got into trouble, and then I got smarter of not getting into trouble and getting caught eventually, right? So that was kind of my introduction to cybersecurity by, you know, crashing my lab server a few times now and then. And then those were the early days of the cybersecurity industry. You know, there are not thousands of companies the way it is today. It was like few companies there, and mostly hackers and handles, and it was mostly fun. You know, we are just curious group of folks trying to learn about computers and how can you get hold of a computer without authorized access and so on, stuff like that, right? So I came from the offense side. My passion was exploitation, you know, writing exploits and testing them and on the penetration testing side, basically. And then that was my night job. In my daytime, I used to do my regular classes and so on in my grad school days. And from there, I got into a startup in India, which was actually probably the first product security company in India. And I was working as a software engineer there. I was fortunate to have got there in the first place. That's also a fascinating story in itself. And then, you know, we got there. So I used to do pen testing in the nights. And then write code in the daytime. Some very similar patterns. I kind of made a decision that this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. And this is like, you know, when you are passionate about something, you're just enjoying and having a great time. You're looking at the time. You're not looking at how much resources you're spending. So it's been like that ever since. I would say it's been over 2 decades now. Time flies. And cyber security continues to be a fascinating area. Every time there are new challenges coming our way. It's kept me busy for sure. Many companies, startups, exits and whatnot. And I still feel that I'm, you know, I can go back almost at that time and feel that, you know, I'm still that guy from college, still fascinated. I'm still equally passionate about cybersecurity as I was when I started.
Yeah, I can just imagine all your product people getting super annoyed when you're nonstop giving them opinions about how to build the product. You know, as somebody who has been there, done that, I'm sure you give a lot of inputs. And, you know, cybersecurity has matured and evolved over the last years, and it's just a great space to be in. But what was the journey like for you from being an engineer to a CEO? Like, were you kind of always the guy who wanted to start a company and kind of run the show? Is that something you learned, or you were kind of like born with that type of trait?
You know what? I never planned to be a CEO. You know, to be honest, that was never an ambition for me. For me, it was all about looking at challenges, coming across them and doing what's right, you know, and to my best ability. That's kind of how I have been all my career. So I never really ever thought I would ever be a CEO. And in fact, I was a bit of an introvert engineer, not someone, you know, who's the, you know, the guy you will be always talking to at the cooler, for example, right? So I think that my career progressed in a direction where it actually became kind of a very natural fit. And when I was, you know, given the role of a CEO, I was actually surprised. And there were a lot of my friends and peers, and they kept on telling me that you have to be a CEO because you have the traits and so on. But I kind of never believed in myself that at some point I will have that kind of a responsibility and a role. Second thing, I think what some of the factors that probably led to that, I was very competitive. I love to compete. I still remember I was at one of my large companies where I was an engineering leader. But in the night, I would sit down and read the wins and losses. Why were we losing against the competitors? This is in the, you know, back many, many years back. So and always open for feedback. You know, there's nobody who's perfect. Nobody can be 100%. And how do you get better? How can you make things better? How can you enable people? That's kind of a very, very simple formula I've had in my entire career. I just followed that consistently. And I think the next piece is being consistent. You know, you can have, you know, various emotions. You can have ups and downs. But, you know, throughout those various emotions and ups and downs which you all encounter, how can you really be consistent? Because I think people and you know, investors and partners, they really appreciate that when, you know, when you can deliver something consistently. So that's kind of one of the other, my other focus areas, how I've trained myself in being consistent, irrespective of the situation. My interest has been always into products and building great products. Then it came into leadership, leading teams, enabling teams, inspiring teams, doing both of those together. And my role evolved into that of a CEO. And I think being an engineer, I can say that for sure now with a first-hand experience, I feel that every engineer should aim to be a CEO, because you are closest to the technology, you are closest, and you have access to the customer and feedback, you know, if you are interested in that. And, you know, you just kind of can have a broader influence, and you can actually make a lot of changes around yourself and enable a lot of people and technologies around you. I would encourage every engineer listening to this podcast to, at some point in their career, consider being a CEO.
Yeah, as you become a CXO suite or person, there is the power dynamics aspect of it, Rahul. You are leaders of leaders, and there is definitely a background that needs to be developed. Is that something you evolved into naturally?
I spent a lot of time training myself. You know, I took a lot of courses. I took, you know, on self, focusing on myself. In fact, I still remember I didn't become a manager until I kind of really felt that I could do justice to the role. You know, and for me, I like to stretch myself. I have stretch goals for myself. But if I can't deliver, I'll just honestly tell you that I'm the wrong person for this role. So I think self-awareness is also very important. It's not that one day I wake up and say, hey, I want to be CEO. For me, just being honest with myself is a very important role, you know, self-awareness and honesty to myself, so that, you know, am I the right guy for this? Can I achieve and overachieve if I sign up for something? And if not, I'm just happy not to, you know, even step into a role like that. And yes, it is a very powerful role. You know? And for me, the way I look at a powerful role is, there are a lot of people depending on you and trusting you. It's a role which also comes with a set of expectations as well. And so, yeah, I mean, you have to kind of really, I think it's a very personal thing. It's a very self-awareness, personal thing, where you can really make a choice and decide for yourself, you know, should you do something like this or not. And you know what? If not, that's fine too. You know, you can influence in so many different ways. Right. So, but I think for me, at least from my perspective, self-awareness is more important than ego. It's not about the title and the power. It's about the value you can provide to the team and the people who are depending on you.
Yeah, great inputs. Speaking of self-awareness, I was just reading actually a little bit about Daniel Ek, who is Spotify CEO, and he talks about that, which is sort of, ultimately, you know, and he's a voracious reader, reads about 60 books a year, and says, like, I'm inspired by Elon Musk, and he does 150 hours a week, whatever that may be. But I got to know myself, and I'm going to run the company that, you know, leverages my superpower. And he talks about, obviously, his superpower. One of the things that you sort of mentioned was what value I bring to the table. So when you are on the table in a typical product review, sales review, what value are you adding?
So I think there are several product, and a role like that is very multidimensional, right? It's about understanding the market, understanding the customers, really qualifying the problem. And then basically, I kind of say that, you know, I have a little bit of a negative modeling of how I look at it, right? So it's like, sometimes, you know, especially in a problem like cybersecurity, where you can do so many things, you have to make a list of things you are not going to do. Because if you are signing up for everything, you can't deliver on that. So I think that kind of a little bit of a reverse psychology can help you to qualify and really make things black and white for yourself in terms of what not to do and what to do, basically, especially when you have a lot of things to do. And cybersecurity is a very good example. That's why it's so interesting for me, is there are so many ways you can solve the same problem. There are so many ways you can slice and dice the different challenges, right? So I think that's one approach. Obviously, I'm probably simplifying this. So I think the decision-making capability is the key aspect when I kind of sit down in a meeting and try to make things black and white. And it might not happen in one meeting. It might take a few meetings. But at the end of the day, clear guidance a crisp idea and a vision and how to move forward is probably my always been my core focus on how I can provide value.
So, Raul, you've been at companies like Silence and Bromium. What experiences there have attributed to this vision? Were there some learnings there which you actively applied at Awake, for example, at those companies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, see, first of all, doing a startup is hard work, as you all probably know, and always the chances of success are slim until we do that, right? So first of all, you need to have that mindset that literally anything can happen. One bad decision you make today, in 2 weeks, the company can completely turn in a wrong direction and be spinning in the wrong direction, right? So you have to be very, very aware and very, very careful, and you have to be watching things very carefully, right? First of all, because it's all ultimately about making decisions, and nobody ever will make the right decision all the time. So you will have to factor in that you will make some bad ones. So yeah, I would say Bromium was a different experience in terms of probably my first real Silicon Valley startup where I came in at the founding time. And I really scaled the company, and I took on a lot of responsibilities, much more than what I had initially signed up for when I joined. I was supposed to be just the security guy having fun there. And then suddenly I was running most of the key areas of focus in that company. And it was a very complex, fascinating technology as well. So there were a lot of challenges for people to understand that. So I was doing a lot of external facing work as well. So that's when I finally managed to create a Twitter account for myself. I still remember I'm not very active on Twitter, as you might have seen. In some cases, I had to move out of my comfort zone and really do what was right for my role at that time. And Romeo was probably the first, and it was a fascinating experience. I met hundreds of customers all over the world, spoke in security conference all over the world. And I was still actively hands-on into exploitation and security research at that time. So I had a blast there, right? Silence was a different nature. Silence was already a unicorn. When I came in there, I was there to scale the team and see what else I could do from a technology point of view. I was giving the technology vision as well as the product vision. So even that was a different kind of challenge, but more from a scaling perspective because the company was really growing very fast. Awake was very different. I came in to Awake to basically, build focus from a go-to-market perspective, as well as, provide the technology and product leadership as well to the founders who kind of invited me to join the company. So yeah, I would say all three of them were a very different set of experiences, and I'm fortunate to go through all three of them. As they say, I can say that each one of them contributed me to where I am today. So I'm actually thankful for all of those.
I have a couple follow-up questions on this one. So one is, obviously when things are on up and up, sometimes a lot of the structural things can kind of get hidden. What did you learn throughout your journey? Whether it's Bromium, Silence, Awake, during the low points of the company's journey, what were some of the key learnings on either product building, go-to-market, company culture, whichever area where you want to focus on?
Yeah, I think lows are very important learning lessons. In fact, I would stress that we should always talk more about lows than the highs, because highs is when you have achieved something, but lows is, it's not about the low, it's about how you respond to the low that determines your next step, where you're going to be after the low, right? Low point. And most startups have that low point. Because, as they say, every startup is a roller coaster, and in a roller coaster, there will be a low and there will be a high, and that's the entire thrill of the ride. So I would say my biggest lesson was really making sure that when there's a low, when there were situations when we did not win and we were going in some of these startups where we were losing ground and not really delivering on the promise, my instinctive reaction was something is wrong here, right? So how do I fix this? And then kind of almost take responsibility for it, which is fine. But, that is not very productive. I can just beat myself up and go in a corner and say, hey, things are not working and I'm responsible. And that's kind of where I really started really sharing and getting the team involved. When there's a situation, when there's a low, I think it's even more important that you're transparent with the team and openly discuss the challenges and really say, break down the challenges into categories. These are different types of challenges we are facing, what they mean, and what can we do together about it. So I think converting those lows into actionable items was a big learning experience for me. I struggled with it in the initial days because First of all, just acknowledging the low point is a tough thing. And many times you just don't want to acknowledge. You sometimes, you know, in your head, you want to say, hey, everything is fine or will be fine eventually, right? And that's mostly wishful thinking. And many of us actually fall in that trap in a low. But I think it's very important that when you hit that low point, it is all about action. Inaction will further dig down the hole of the low and make it worse for you. So my biggest lesson was really take action, take charge, and stand up, especially as leaders, because that's the time where your leadership is really tested, truly tested. So yeah, I think that's one big lesson, you know, action and not inaction in a low time. I think also the next piece that I mentioned was really being transparent with the team, really share and discuss what's not working and what can we do about it. So I think getting involved and getting more people involved instead of just making it just my problem or somebody else's problem.
Knowing what you know now, what could you have done differently to have Cylance reach CrowdStrike-like success, for example? If you were running the show, you know, had all the cards, what would you have done differently?
Yeah, I mean, I would say there certainly was potential there for sure. I think, you know, focusing on the core products, you know, which we had, which were fairly good and worked very well, because the market was big enough, would have probably been given us more muscle in terms of execution and going after the market, kind of what CrowdStrike has been doing consistently. So I think focus is one piece which is very important, and not branching out into too many things. That's one thing. And then also, I think the market also kind of changed a little bit, right? Cylance was more on the antivirus, the next-gen antivirus, and EDR was the next big incoming thing. I think executing on that faster would have made a bigger impact for sure. But not to forget, Cylance probably still till date is probably the fastest billion-dollar exit in cybersecurity. So we still did okay, but no, always there's a lesson learned. Always there is something we can do better in terms of execution.
Good stuff. You know, we're suckers for learning about sort of failures, and I think you gave definitely some good insight. So I want to switch gears a little bit, start talking about the decision-making process as a CEO. So, you know, you're constantly getting feedback and signals from internal stakeholders like engineering, marketing, sales teams, and external stakeholders like customers and VCs and analysts. Who do you pay attention to, and how do you separate signal from noise?
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it. We are surrounded by a world of opinions, and people don't hold back on their opinions. I am probably equally to be blamed on that. So I think one of the abilities I have really built in myself has been to listen. And listen from the perspective of where the person who's talking to me, where they are coming from, as opposed to where I want to listen from, right? So that kind of gives me a kind of, in some sense, a little bit objective views of everybody's opinions and where everybody's coming from. So I factor everything in, and I try very hard not to make, when I'm making a decision, an important decision rather, I'm not emotional in that decision-making phase. I'm really being very, very objective. And so that's why, you know, I've been able to make tough decisions when I have to make tough decisions and move swiftly. And at the same time, you know, I've also sat on issues when, you know, when something is not super urgent and I don't have to create the urgency. So we can sometimes get sucked into this whole cycle of creating urgencies when there is no urgency.
Important and urgent.
Yes.
Four quadrants. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Absolutely. So I think drawing that mentally in your head for every decision is so important. Otherwise, you can just waste a lot of time, not only your time, everybody else's time, right? And then at the same time, you may not get it right all the time because, you know, nobody can always be 100% accurate. But if you do make a mistake, make sure you go and correct it. Don't get stuck. Don't have your ego come in. Don't say that, hey, you know what, I made a mistake. No, let me just move on from here. And instead of saying that, hey, this is not my problem, I already made that decision, right? So I think really also, it's not just about the decision also, but it's also about following through on the decision and really making sure that it is working the way and you're getting the desired outcome, right? It's not just you make a decision and you are kind of scot-free. It's not that, right?
Yeah, but if you're listening more, then more people are giving you opinions. So the fundamental problem still remains. I mean, you've got VCs telling you like, hey, Rahul, 10x everything you were doing and hire 100 more people. Yeah. Your leadership team is like, no, we got to be conservative. You know, like there's, you know, resource scarcity, etc. Do you have a mental model? Is it all contextual, right? Depending on the day and the decision, the type of decision you listen to one stakeholder versus the other. Like, am I giving you false choices where, like, you know, you don't have to make trade-offs or do these situations really happen?
Yeah, so I would say there, I have some kind of a mental model now that you make me think in that way, right? I would say it's a time-based decision model. Depending upon the type of challenge I'm dealing with, sometimes some decisions need longer time duration, some are quick to make. So it's time-bound. I'm not going to be doing analysis, paralysis, and listening to everybody. Sometimes I may not even have to listen to everybody to make a decision because it's very clear. Sometimes I really have to because I don't know enough about it. I'm not educated enough about it. So all decisions have to be time-bound. Otherwise, you are just not being decisive fundamentally, right? So that's the first thing. But at the same time, time-bound in the sense that, you know, you cannot kind of create a self-pressure for yourself, say that, hey, I have this, you know, you can't really pinpoint and give a specific timeline that, hey, this is a decision-making matrix. Everything is unique. So you have to be really understand and build the context around how you make the decision and by what time is meaningful, right? So yeah, I think I would say the time element is important in decision making because I have come across people and situations, and sometimes even I get stuck where you are in that analysis paralysis mode and there is no action. So I would say it's very important that all the decisions you're making are time based.
Having your North Stars is very important to avoid churn, right? As you were talking, and hiring and retaining top talent should be one of those for great CEOs. Reed Hastings talks a lot about talent density in the company, and there's so much to go around. How did you do it in Awake?
Yeah, that was actually fascinating. In fact, at Awake, we were doing some statistics. We had negative attrition. In fact, people who had left came back because they loved the culture of the company so much, which is, by the way, very rare in Silicon Valley, right?
It is, yeah.
So we had a very, very high quality, and we won several awards for best places consistently. And it was the team advertising, you know, for us in terms of recruiting. And so I think it was a sense of ownership that the team created, we managed to create for everybody for the company, right? It's about it's about doing the right thing. And everybody felt empowered that they had the choice to make the right decisions for the company. You know, they were contributing, they were making a difference. So there was a very strong sense of ownership in all the engineering teams and all the other leadership as well. So I think that was a very key element in terms of really why Awake did so well when it came to retaining talent and so on. So we had this very interesting, you know, from a culture point of view, I had created this formula, we actually joke about it. It's called BPU, believe, persist, and be unreasonable, right? So like these were some of the three foundations on which we kind of build the entire company on in some sense, right? First of all is believe in yourself, the team, and the product. If you don't, you know what? You should not be here. There are a lot of good places to be in. But if you're not a believer, you should not be in a startup fundamentally. So that's so pivotal and critical.
Yeah.
Persist, especially in cybersecurity, you know, where attackers are persistent and never going to give up. You know, you have to persist and you don't give up. So that's the other piece where we had issues, we had challenges. We spent weekends and nights and whatnot together as a team. We persisted. And the next part was unreasonable. You know, if you want unreasonable outcome, if you want success, which is, you know, off the charts, you have to be unreasonable with yourself. You have to get out of your comfort zone. It's not just about drawing boundaries about what you know. It's about what is possible and how you can contribute. So these three, some of the, I would say, themes were a very integral part of the culture of the company. And we used to joke about it, like, you know, Amazon runs on GPU. We run on BPU, right? It's kind of that was the internal joke in the company. So yeah, I think that was some of the culture we incubated completely ground up. And I think ultimately, when you bring a bunch of smart people who have a sense of ownership and responsibility, that's like the most powerful force on the planet, which can really move mountains for you. Anything is possible. I am a big believer of that. And I think this is what we created in Awake. That's why it was so much fun. And we had a blast, absolutely.
Yeah, what I've seen in companies that have strong sense of ownership, the decision making kind of happens across the chain. And I think that spurs a lot of right decisions to be done. But what also comes with that is there is always confusion where the decision making is happening, because a lot of times the context doesn't travel all the way up and the decision making happens there. Were there, with the BPU model, were there certain things where, you know, the decision-making kind of sat at different levels and that kind of spurred this growth?
Yeah, I would say it was fairly decentralized. You know, everybody was empowered. We had team leads. We had, you know, people who were making decisions on the product side. So we had a high level view of what we were doing, and we kind of trusted each other to deliver on their key competencies. And then when they would get stuck, they would come to me. If I was making all the key decisions, I would become a bottleneck very soon as well, right? So I think we kind of really incubated that very well. And that also is a function of really having great people, great team leaders who were partners with me in the Awake journey. And because they were fairly independent, they could take on challenges and just deliver on them. So I think that was a very key element. But at the same time, there were times when we got stuck, when everybody got stuck, and then we'll sit down and declog ourselves and say, okay, this is how we move forward from here. And yeah, we used to do a quick huddle together.
How has your perspective on hiring changed post-COVID in terms of where to hire, who to hire, etc.?
I think COVID has flattened the hiring scene. In fact, even before COVID, we had created a culture where we'll go for talent and not location. That's kind of how we built the entire infrastructure around that theme. And that actually helped us in during COVID time, because my engineering team was like, hey, life is normal. I mean, you know, I'm just at home as I was, and I'm delivering, you know, as I was. But it is definitely a little, for me, it was a bit challenging because I'm used to being with people, you know. For me, I think, and like the first 2 weeks, I'm like, oh my God, what the hell is going on here, right? I can't even go to office. I'm used to be doing like hundreds of thousands of miles a year, traveling and meeting people and customers, and I'm like suddenly locked down in my room. I can't even go out. It is definitely very different and challenging, because there's a huge element of personalities and, you know, and really understanding people in the interview process. And that generally happens face to face, right? And now you are completely relying on Zoom pretty much. So there was definitely a learning curve for us, and I'm sure probably for the entire industry. But from a philosophy point of view, I think it kind of helped us to also understand that, you know what, we can all be productive without spending hours on 101 traffic, and we can actually deliver stuff from home. Not sure how long this will last. You know, half of my team is ready to run back to office the moment the office opens up. And the other half is actually, you know what, I don't need to go to office. You know, I can work from home. Why should I go to office? It's a waste of time, right? So I think the world will be kind of divided after COVID opens. It'll be a while before things go back to normal, they probably would never go to normal, back to normal from what I see so far.
What we've seen is engineering teams and startups specifically are able to keep up with the COVID changes. But I think the sales struggles a bit, because just like you, they're used to meeting customers. They are used to getting in the office. What were some of the things you changed? Did you change anything in the business model or, you know, go-to-market messaging so that the sales funnel kept on going as it should?
We tried to do several things. Not everything was successful. One thing we did was, first of all, we did, I think, very early on, within like the second month, we were doing lunch and learn over Uber Eats. We were sending via Uber Eats food to people's homes and then over Zoom, having a lunch and learn session. So we did adapt to that. We did do touchless sale concept, where without touch, without shaking hands, how can you sell? So we created some plans around that. We did targeting for, you know, verticals where you have a, you know, better chance of success being a startup, instead of going after verticals which were just not, you know, going to be listening to you, for example, the media, entertainment, and some of the other verticals which were hit hard. So we did some repositioning on the go-to-market side. And then also, there were a few people who were doing well, you know, people who have had an inside sales background. They did phenomenally well, because that's kind of what they have been doing, right? And now suddenly everybody is at home, right? And in many cases, even picking up their phone. So we sat down and tried to learn from them. And hey, you know, why are things working for you? How are you able to get so many POCs where everybody else is struggling, right? So we kind of gave feedback to each other as well in when something was working. But we experimented quite a lot. And I would say we had like probably 60% success or so. So it was not a slam dunk, because we were learning and adapting to the situation.
Great. How do you know when to exit? You know, you have examples where the company was a unicorn, but didn't turn out to be the case. I was part of a similar journey. But then you have opposite examples. YouTube would be worth $100 billion right now, and so would be Instagram, and they sold it for cheap. How do you decide when to exit?
That's a very hard hard call, you know, even for any CEO of a startup.
Yeah, that's why we have smarter people than we are on this podcast.
So I would say for me, I have a, first of all, as a CEO, you have a fiduciary duty to your investors and the employees. So that's something, is a reminder that any CEO or somebody who wants to be a CEO needs to remember that it's a duty, it's a fiduciary duty that you do the right for the company. And in many cases, markets, you just don't know how the market is going to react. This could be the next big exit which you will repent later, or you made I know many cases where people did not take the exit when it came, and then it didn't go anywhere after that as well, right? So I've been a part of some of those as well in my journey. I think it's again going back to objective time-based decision making, if I may call it that term. I just created that term. because when something comes to your table, you have to be clear it's all time-based, and you have to really objectively analyze the market. What are the movements in the market? And sometimes, you know, acquisitions can really enable you to take the technology and the team to a completely new level, which you might not be able to do as a small startup, right? Especially given in a circumstance like COVID, for example, right? From an Awake perspective, now that we have Arista, we are growing really fast. We have a huge machinery behind us, which we just did not have access to, right?
Yeah.
So I think you also have to observe the market conditions and know, is this really the right thing to do? And right or wrong is such a hard call to be. It's a very tricky one. And I would say every scenario would be unique. It would be very hard for me to give you kind of a formula for this. And because if there was a formula, I would love to get an insight into that formula for sure. it is certainly a tough one. But at the same time, you have to remember that you have to do the right thing for the company and the team and the investors. And that's where your responsibility and your delivering on the promise really comes into picture.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for engaging us on these really, you know, deep and, you know, difficult question. But we recognize that life is much beyond the exits and technology. It's also about other things. One of your passions is girls' education and empowering them to go into technology and security. Tell us more about it.
Absolutely. I personally believe that we don't have enough diversity, especially in cybersecurity. And I have kind of been in cybersecurity from the very beginning of the cybersecurity industry, right? So I've seen the entire industry grow. And I fundamentally believe that's not correct. It's not the way it should be. So I've teamed up with some nonprofits. I'm very active with a nonprofit called eGirl Power, which is where I mentor girl students from different walks of society to really help them understand what is cybersecurity and really get comfortable about the possibility of taking on a career in cybersecurity. So I've been involved with them for a while. And for me, it's kind of a personal mission because I feel that this is something, there's an imbalance here. And I believe that I'm fortunate enough where I can make a small impact there, a small dent and make a difference there. So that's kind of one of my weekend projects. I do talk to several young girls in their high school in that age group, because that's the age group when you really are thinking about what's next in your life, right? If you go grad school and later, it's a little bit too late, right? So for people to really know that there's something called cybersecurity, I kind of give them some, I have like built a small formula of, what kind of books to read, how to build a lab, how to learn cybersecurity skills. And cybersecurity has become such a vast industry now. There are so many things to do, right? There's something for everybody, literally. So this has been my, passion for on working on this project, basically. I've been working on it for the past few years. And I've had some success there, and I really intend to continue on this mission in the next few years. Hopefully, I would have made an impact there and kind of introduce some balance in the industry.
Rahul, thank you for that. My daughter would be going into high school next year, so I will remember this and make sure that she spends some time with you, because she refuses to listen to the parents. So
yes.
An outside voice always helps. That brings us to the last and final segment of the pod, the rapid fire round. So I'm going to ask you some very simple questions. You can answer in brief. Are you ready?
All right.
Yeah, don't worry. It's going to be fun.
Okay.
What are you reading or listening to nowadays?
I'm reading Barack Obama's latest book right now. Podcasts, I listen to several podcasts, mostly NPR. Mm-hmm. And I do follow a podcast actively called The Knowledge Project. St. Paris. I'm a big fan of that podcast, and this kind of my personal passion as well. So yeah, so this is what I'm doing right now.
And now you will listen to ours as well, right, Rahul?
Absolutely. It's on my my list now.
Any inspirations in the women empowerment area?
So yeah, I would say, you know, there are quite a few women who have been really successful. And I would say probably the CEO, Arista Jayashree, is one, you know, completely self-made and probably one of the most successful executives in Silicon Valley and a true, you know, truly great person to work with as well. I'm very fortunate now that I have a woman CEO-led company where I'm learning from her. That's a fascinating experience, and I really look forward to that as well. So yeah, so there's a lot of inspiration from there. It's a great feeling for me to really be under Jayashree, to be honest. Yeah, so that's one piece. The other piece, I would say, I have a lot of inspiration from my mother as well, who kind of has been behind me through my entire journey as well. So there's a lot of women in my life who have really helped me, influenced me, not to forget my wife. So there are a lot of women. I'm surrounded by a lot of powerful women, and I'm very thankful and honored to be a part of their life as well.
Looking back, one low point and one high point in your career.
One low point was, you know, when we lost a very big deal, which I was kind of, we thought we would be winning in my, you know, which was like the perfect deal to win in one of my startups. And we had everything aligned, everything was set up, and we kind of, it was very disappointing then that, you know, we did not make it, because that would have been a game-changing deal for the company. And sometimes, you know, deals like that can change the entire trajectory of a company, right? So that was one low point, and we got a lot of feedback and we learned a lot from that. High point, I would say definitely the acquisition of Awake was definitely a high point. I can definitely, you know, I felt that I contributed to that, coming to an exit there. Definitely a high point. And I'm sure there's a lot more I still need to do, but I would definitely count that as a high point.
Great. One advice you'd give to your younger self?
Okay, you said these are going to be easy questions. So to my younger self, I would say probably, you know, spend more time on myself, probably. I get involved with a lot of other things. I sometimes lose perspective in terms of my own fitness and health. So I would say having that balance is important. And I've kind of learned that in the last few years, and I've been diligent about it. But I think I could have been much better earlier on in terms of really focusing on myself inward, inside out as well.
Rahul as a hacker or Rahul as a CEO?
Rahul as a hacker.
Should you fake it till you make it?
No.
Silence or Arista or McAfee?
Arista.
And last question, who should we invite next to the pod?
Well, there are so many great people. I'll give you a list. Of people.
Yes, and you have to introduce us all to them as well, right?
So absolutely will do. Yeah, absolutely will do.
Okay, that wraps us for a great episode today. Thank you, Rahul, for spending time with us. Hopefully we'll meet you again in a year when you would have done more things at Arista. Thank you
Nilima and Ankur, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck, Rahul. Thanks a lot for taking the time.